can't verify George Bush's Read My List. We can verify if
okay.
we...
I'm
sorry?
Some videotape.
but how do we prove it? How do we go into his state of mind? How do we verify that there will be no new taxes? There is, it's one of those opinions that can't be dug into. But we could. Walter Carr was a prominent citizen of the city of South Houston. He went to the city hall daily. He snooped around. He got into everybody's business. He talked to city council members. He knew what was going on. He knew the exact sources he could go to find out what that $23,000 really meant. But he chose to tell the people of the city of South Houston that that $23,000 was a payoff to cronies of Lynn Brasher's. There are cases that, and I submitted a list of new cases this morning, and I assume that you haven't gotten them yet, but these are cases that I had not referred to in my brief, and one of them is called Zarangi versus TSC Newspapers. That's a Fifth Circuit 1987 case, and it discusses Liberty Lobby, and it discusses Gertz and the Sullivan standards. And in that case, what the court held was that although the defendant's state of mind is a subjective fact, it can be shown by indirect or circumstantial evidence. In that case, the defendant newspaper printed a story that had a false statement of a conviction for exchanging an early release or weekend release in exchange for stolen goods with a convict. These people were the two defendants, or the two plaintiffs in the libel suit were officers, wardens or something. On the next day, the one of the men called, Durangi called the newspaper and said, that's not true. I was convicted for something, but it was not that I was releasing this man in exchange for stolen goods. And in fact, those charges had been dropped. And the next day, the newspaper ran an article that corrected that. But 2 weeks later, another reporter in the same small newspaper picked up that first article and reran that same statement about him being convicted for exchange of stolen goods. And the Fifth Circuit held, and the reporter submitted an affidavit saying that she didn't know that that retraction was in the file. She didn't see it. It didn't come up on the computer print. And the Fifth Circuit said that the reporter's credibility was obviously crucial, and the plaintiffs raised more than a possibility that a jury might disbelieve the reporter. It said that they had produced some evidence concerning the newspaper's operation and the close interrelation of the events in the sequence of events and the people from which a jury could reasonably infer the requisite knowledge to meet the actual malice standard.
So you see no difference in a political campaign versus regular discourse and everyday business?
I wouldn't say that I see no difference, no. I think that there is, as I think Mr. Medoff is right, the closer you get to political rhetoric, the closer you get to the tougher the standard. I would have to agree with that.
Well, this is as close as you can get.
Except that there are statements of fact in this political brochure that he calls a political brochure that tell the readers Mr. Brasher is a crook. He doesn't use that word, but that's the inference that he gives to the readers. He tells the readers specifics about how Mr. Brasher is a crook.
If he said, in my political views, he's a crook, would that have been a problem?
You know, that if he said, in my political view, I think that then if he still then gives the specific statements, the specific allegations of paying Patricia Burgess city money for personal bookkeeping, then even though he gives the disclaimer, I think it's still a statement of fact that he could have verified, that he chose not to. It's out of the Ullman opinion. It is a statement of fact. And even though it is political, it is defamatory to Mr. Brasher because it makes Mr. Brasher, to the citizens of South Houston, appear to be something that he is not.
But he says, it's my opinion, he's a crook. Where does that fall?
That's the answer, the question I just answered. It, even though he gives that disclaimer, as long as he combines that with all of those specific facts wherein he's saying, it's not just my opinion, really. Even though I tell you it's my opinion, I really have evidence of it. And he's saying that by stating all those specifics. I think then that disclaimer is worthless. It's self-serving. It's just like his affidavit.
Summary judgment evidence, in your opinions, establish the falsity of some of these statements?
Yes.
I mean, you put in documents on it.
Yes, I did. Yes. And also the summary judgment evidence establishes ill will. Now, I know that that takes it out of that actual malice standard a little bit, but some of these other cases that following Zerenghi say that the evidence of ill will also is circumstantial evidence that can be that from which a reasonable jury can infer that the actual malice exists. And
well, a political candidate frequently has ill will towards his or her opponent. I mean, this is a difficult matter to show the kind of the actual malice that one might bear for one's opponent actuates making a false statement.
It's very difficult.
That are knowingly, obviously, more than knowingly false, they're made with a malicious.
It's a very difficult matter, and the very fact of its difficulty makes it an issue that the jury should hear, because the evidence is that Walter Carr created, he didn't just get some UPI report, he created these brochures. He put them together for a specific purpose of getting rid of Lynn Brasher, for hurting him. Now, Lynn Brasher's affidavit gives further information about the ill will. He states in his affidavit that Walter Carr had been the municipal judge for a great number of years. When Lynn Brasher was elected, he refused to reappoint Walter Carr. And in fact, he had him audited, and he found that there were thousands of warrants that had been dismissed or that had never been served. And when Walter Carr discovered that he was being audited, he set out on a campaign to hurt Lynn Brasher. Not only did he hurt him, he hurt this Ms. Burgess. He set out to have the district attorney indict Ms. Burgess for supposedly holding herself out as a CPA. That type of evidence is crucial for a jury to hear. The judge on paper isn't supposed to determine the credibility of either Lynn Brasher or Walter Carr. And yet, according to the Liberty Lobby standard, the judge would have to do that. And I think that under Texas law, that would not be appropriate, and under the current Texas law, of course. But let me say that even if you choose to adopt the Liberty Lobby standard, I think that Lynn Brasher should proceed to trial in this case, even under that heightened standard, because he has produced concrete evidence of actual malice. He has produced enough evidence, if not direct evidence, at least of indirect and circumstantial evidence from which a jury could reasonably infer that actual malice exists.
You can, you have cases. Now, I know you say this is irrelevant, and it may well be, but just to humor me, you have cases that show that you can infer enough evidence to reach a clear and convincing standard? And I mean, perhaps in malice, that's all you could ever do. I mean, if you can't infer it, it can't be done.
It's a subjective state of mind.
But we're not in Houston, in Texas, to clear and convincing as a standard, as perhaps Lutherans are in some other states, because we generally use that for submission to the jury only when the United States Supreme Court tells us we have to for some reason.
That's correct. And
they told us in this area we have to, and so we're still groping.
We're following that, but they haven't told us that we have to do the summary judgment. And you know, my view, of course, is that we shouldn't have to do the heightened summary judgment standard. Well, I think the Zerenghi case is a Fifth Circuit case, of course, and I don't have any Texas cases that would tell us that we can infer that. But I think that case is probably the best one that you can go to for that specific issue. And it cites some other cases. It cites the older Curtis Publishing versus Butts, and then it cites Golden Bear. It cites a couple of others that I don't believe were in my brief. And those inferences, some of which I think the Curtis one was a failure to investigate weakened by an interest, an inherent improbability or internal inconsistencies or apparently reliable contrary information, and that was, the jury was allowed to draw the inference from that type of situation. Or I think Golden Bear, I'm not sure if Golden Bear was actually an inference case, but I believe it was, where the reporter's own notes showed that she should have been aware of the facts contradictory to the, her story. I'd like to also say that you know, I've already pointed out that, I think Brasher has met even the heightened standard. I think Brasher's clearly met the standard under our, Texas summary judgment. Mr. Carr himself made it apparent that he was a businessman who knew what was going on, and given all of the permissible inferences that we could draw, the inference, and the jury could draw the inference that, yes, Mr. Carr had actual malice. He knew, or he reasonably, recklessly published false statements because he could have gone to the correct sources. In St. Amant versus Thompson, the Supreme Court, and that's prior to Lobby, of course, but the Supreme Court stated that sufficient indirect evidence can defeat the defendant's unsupported statement that he did act in good faith.
Good. I'm on you, so.
Is my time up?
You get a red light.
Okay. I'd like to finish with just a summary. I think this is an important case, and I think you all agree that you know, you've got to make a tough decision here. This is the type of case, this is the type of libel that is the most difficult to rule on. It is the type of libel that is the most difficult for someone to rebut. You saw the affidavit of Lynn Brasher. It was pages and pages long just for summary judgment, just to rebut Walter Carr's statement that I didn't do anything in bad faith. Mr. Brasher took pages and pages to respond to each of the allegations in the brochures that could be defamatory. And he, if he had to go to the voters and, you know, publish reams of paper to rebut the allegations that, he paid off his cronies, that he paid his, quote, personal bookkeeper city money, it would be practically impossible. And that kind of innuendo and juxtaposition is precisely the kind of thing that can kill a political candidate, and it can ruin for life, you know, someone's business. It can be so defamatory that it can, you know, actually be fatal. And I think what this court has to decide is, you know, do we want to subject every city council or every potential city council member, potential mayor, potential judge, potential attorney general, and their families to the kind of malicious and slanderous attack that occurred in these four brochures.
Counsel, do you were all of the statements made in the four brochures that you claim are defamatory, did they arise out of activities of Mr. Brasher in connection with his public service, as opposed to completely outside business or personal activities?
No, I was going to say yes, but I believe there was something in there about his business. There was some innuendo about Mr. Brasher's mortgage company not really being what he holds it out to be. So that would have been outside of the political process. But everything else, I believe everything else had to do with where he was coming from as the mayor of the city of South Houston.
Let me ask you one final question. You made a statement about people being ruined for life due to chronic and political campaigns. Do you know of any literature, either historical or modern behavioral literature, about the effect of damaging statements on people in campaigns and how widely that's believed, how generally successful it is? I think the long, broad-term history of our national campaigns is that things are getting cleaner and cleaner. and I think that's true in local campaigns too, over the long view of hundreds of years.
No, I don't. I apologize. I don't have anything support that statement. But
yes, if we're taking a broad view of our social policy of what we're doing, it might be helpful. To have that kind of
it would be, Your Honor. But I would say that we do know that what we want is the voters to be able to believe what they read and what they hear. That's part of that democratic process. We want to elect candidates who are fit for the job. And so part of that is, can we believe what we're being told about the candidates?
Thank you.
Your Honors, on page 418, on volume 418 of the U.S. Reporters, page 281, the United States Supreme Court states emphatically, ill will is not part of the New York Times standard. I listened to counsel's argument in this case, and I did not hear Al Thiel's name mentioned one time in this case. That is because the only evidence in this case of actual malice on the part of Al Thiel is that he was a candidate for mayor. And if that is evidence enough to impute or allow an inference of actual malice, i.e. knowing falsity or reckless disregard for the truth, to get to the jury, then everyone, every candidate for office, in everything he says, has the requisite state of mind to allow his case to go to the jury. That's the only evidence in this case against Al Thiel. That cannot be enough evidence of malice to allow this case to go to the jury. With respect to Justice's question, Broussard versus Moon, 431 Southwest 2nd, 534, provides that the standard for a directed verdict, the evidentiary standard, is the same as it is for summary judgment. In logic and in law, I'm sorry?
What was that case?
Broussard versus Moon, 431 Southwest 2nd, 534. There is no reason in logic or in law not to apply the Liberty Lobby standard to the summary judgment stage.
What do you do with two explicit references in our Texas Constitution to the right to bring a suit for defamation?
Your Honor, Mr. Brasher has his right to bring his lawsuit for defamation, provided he has sufficient evidence to get his case to the jury, just as a personal injury plaintiff has the right to bring his lawsuit, provided he has sufficient evidence to get to the jury.
Doesn't that put some duty on this court, though, to interpret the federal constitutional requirements as narrowly as the Supreme Court will let us in order to give some content to those states?
Your Honor, I'm in favor of that as a matter of principle anyway. But wholly apart from that, I believe Texas summary judgment law, in logic and in law, requires application of Anderson versus Liberty Lobby. If a defamation defendant brings forward sufficient evidence to show no malice, no actual malice, i.e. knowing falsity or serious doubts about the truth, entitling him to summary judgment, then the burden shifts to the moving party to bring forward sufficient evidence to raise a fact issue.
The counsel, it almost seems after Liberty Lobby, the United States Supreme Court has said you've got to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt before you can get over the hurdle of summary judgment.
As Your Honor is aware, beyond a reasonable doubt is the highest evidentiary standard we have in this country. Clear and convincing is an intermediate standard between preponderance and beyond a reasonable doubt. Clear and convincing says you have got to bring forward some evidence that really demonstrates that the speaker had serious doubts or knew the falsity of the statements. There is no logical reason that I can see not to require a plaintiff, a defamation plaintiff, to bring forward clear and convincing evidence at the summary judgment stage. Otherwise, as has been observed, I think, by Justice Phillips, we are engaging in a useless act. We are going to wait until the directed verdict, and then we're going to grant a directed verdict when we had the reason to grant it at the summary judgment stage. Furthermore, with respect to Justice Gonzalez's point on depositions, the difference between a deposition and an affidavit is that the adversary system allows the cross-examination of the person making the testimony. This allows the lawyer who is opposing the summary judgment to say, I have this evidence that you knew of the falsity of the statements. I have this evidence, as in Liberty Lobby, I have this evidence that you may have been told that there was some doubt about the truth of these statements beforehand. It allows the cross-examiner to bring out the weaknesses, if the cross-examiner is able to do that, in the testimony regarding state of mind. And it seems to me that that cross-examiner should have that evidence available to him at that time, or the case should not be in court to begin with. As Justice Phillips said, political speech is at the core of the speech protected by the First Amendment. The United States Supreme Court in New York Times versus Sullivan followed the late Alexander Micheljohn's arguments taken in his from his book, Freedom of Speech, in which he detailed the history of this country and the use of the town hall meeting in New England as a forum for bringing forward political discussion. And it was out of this background, this history of political discussion, that the United States Supreme Court felt in New York Times versus Sullivan that the First Amendment should accord greater protection to speech about public officials and public figures. This speech is at the very core of the speech protected by the First Amendment.
You come out of an interesting context here, an election of 4,500 voters apparently. If this mailing was indeed a universal mailing, where presumably most of those voters knew both candidates and had some means of research, like the New England town meeting. But whatever policy we make here will apply throughout this state, more like 9 or 10 million voters. It sometimes has been said that freedom of press guarantees freedom to anybody that owns a printing press. We are talking about the ability to put this kind of information out to an electorate that is not vitally interested in the issues of the day and all the campaign, and put it out, disseminated with millions of dollars behind it. If one can do that with near impunity, that is, knowing that the other side is going to have to raise summary judgment evidence to show actual knowledge and reckless disregard of that, is that really going to help the political discourse or not?
Your Honor, I'm of the firm opinion that it will. And in fact, I think history shows, as you stated earlier, that even though we now feel our campaigns are much more rough and tumble now, any reading of history will show that the campaigns in the old days, so to speak, in the years immediately following the Revolutionary War, the accusations of false parentage, the sorts of scurrilous accusations involving mistresses and illegitimate children, the campaigns were much more rough and tumble then than they are now. The ability to respond on the part of the public official is much greater. And that, of course, is why the protection was granted in the first place.
There were a lot of libel suits arising out of those campaigns.
There were libel.
Sam Houston sued one of his opponents twice, 2 years, right?
That's true, Your Honor. I would also point out, in closing, that in considering the summary judgment granted Al Thiel, we are now considering only one brochure. The Court of Appeals sustained the trial court's summary judgment for Al Thiel with respect to his claim that three of the brochures were barred by the statute of limitations. Therefore, we are only dealing with one brochure, and for your information, is the brochure that talks about aardvarks and giraffes in the animal house. That's the one that we're here on. We are not here on the other three brochures. Finally, counsel raised one other point regarding not having a full opportunity to discover. This was raised at the first time here today in respondents' arguments in this court. Respondent did not ask for more discovery in the lower court and did not raise that in the Court of Appeals. For these reasons, respectfully request that the court affirm the summary judgment granted by the Court of Appeals in favor of Al Thiel.
In the few minutes I have, I want to simply address
part of what I think is at the heart of this case, and that is the context in which these statements were made and in which these brochures were distributed, point raised by Justice Heck earlier. Because I think ultimately what is constitutionally protected opinion and what is reckless disregard for truth or falsity has to be examined in the context in which the statements are made and the brochures distributed. An examination of these brochures makes it obvious that this is not the front page of the New York Times, where a reader could reasonably expect some fair and balanced accounting of the news of the day. This is not the editorial page of the Washington Post, where a reader could reasonably expect some well-crafted opinion in decorous prose. This is political speech in its purest form. This, in the final analysis, is one man standing on the corner soapbox raging against the established order. The rhetoric is rambling, sometimes raucous, and full of self-righteousness, but it is fully protected. These pamphlets, these political pamphlets, are a form of speech as old as the Republic itself, born of a time when angry men railed against their king, born of a time when John Peter Zenger could be prosecuted for criminal libel for daring to unfairly criticize the crown. This is political speech in its purest form. The views in the view of some may be misguided. If there are mistakes of fact, there is no showing as a matter of law of actual malice. If this one man can be brought into court and cross-examined for 7 hours, who told you that? Where did you get that information? Did you double-check your source? Did you check with your editor? Did you run this by your opponent? Did you give him a chance to respond? If every man and every woman as an individual is subjected to that, then we have effectively chilled free speech for many, many people, those who cannot, because of the enormous resources involved, defend a full-blown libel suit. It is so very important that protection be afforded at the summary judgment stage, because this, in the final analysis, is the man on the soapbox. Perhaps wrong, perhaps misguided, whatever your view may be, that it is fully protected by the First Amendment. And we would respectfully urge that the Court of Civil Appeals be reversed, that the trial court be affirmed in all respects. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court will now take a brief recess.